everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. And today we're celebrating RNIB's 150th anniversary in books and voices, both past and present. Robert Kirkwood explores the biography of RNIB's founding father, Thomas Rhodes Armitage.
The string records of Peru, in which different forms of knots made on a string stand for different letters. And the blind man was able to read by running the string through his fingers.
One of RNIB's longest-serving narrators, Elizabeth Proud, discusses the evolution of the talking book.
And then came stereo, where the microphone was set against the wall and we stood round in a circle.
RNIB's Director of Development, Keith Valentine, talks about the future and his love of accessible books.
When I say a zest for life and optimism, I'm not in any way saying, oh, it's easy, have a cup of tea and get on with it. You know, I understand how tough it can be.
And we unwrap a very special gift, a 150-word story written specially for our 150th anniversary by gifted blind author Paola Peretti. All that and more coming up in today's Read On.
RNIB is 150 years old. The charity started life in the home of Thomas Rhodes Armitage as the British and Foreign Society for Improving the Embossed Literature of the Blind, and later the British and Foreign Blind Association for Promoting the Education and Employment of the Blind. Thomas Rhodes Armitage trained as a doctor, retiring in the 1850s due to failing sight. He formed the British and Foreign Society in 1868, later attacking the utter confusion produced by a babel of systems for reading embossed type. He documented this process in his book, The Education and Employment of the Blind, What It Has Been, Is and Ought to Be, which he wrote in 1871.
The object of the present work is to put together in an accessible and condensed form some of the more important facts relating to the education and employment of the blind. It has hitherto been extremely difficult for those interested in this subject to ascertain what is being done at the different schools in this and foreign countries, and there has been a total absence of any organised investigation undertaken by men who have made the education of the blind their special study. It seems self-evident that the proper persons to decide upon the best methods of instruction by touch are those who have to rely upon this sense, the blind themselves. And that those among the blind should be entrusted with this work who, from their education and antecedents, may be expected to approach so important a question with the requisite preliminary knowledge.
Although this wasn't reflected in a name change until 2002, from the very beginning, the institution wasn't for the blind, it was of the blind, being led from the start by people with sight loss.
A good education is of extreme importance to the blind, as by its aid many will succeed in life who without it would have been helpless, unhappy, and a burden to their friends or to society. Consequently, the elementary processes by which this education is to be brought about deserve the most careful investigation. Uniformity in the alphabet used by the blind has long been desired by all. But as each system has its own uncompromising advocates, we are still far from so desirable a result. The blind have, however, now taken matters into their own hands, and the closer union between those of different countries is already bringing about the happiest results in disseminating information, cheapening and improving educational apparatus, and raising the standard of education, and with it, the happiness and well-being of the blind throughout the civilised world.
Armitage doesn't talk much about his own life in the book, except this passage where he laments the end of his medical career, but accepts that his new role could prove much more useful to the blind and partially sighted community.
For about 10 years, gradually increasing loss of sight has incapacitated me from following my profession. And though this does not amount to blindness, it is sufficient to preclude the possibility of reading by sight. In judging, therefore, of the merits of the various means of education used by the blind, I must depend upon the sense of touch. And, acting in concert with the other members of the Executive Council of the Association, who are all totally blind, I have had the advantage of the constant cooperation of 5 highly educated blind gentlemen, who for the most part, like myself, are familiar with every system of embossed printing which has obtained currency among the blind. The belief that I have been able to take my share in this great work has gone far to reconcile me to the abandonment of my profession, to the scientific prosecution of which I had hoped to devote my life. But the very defect of sight which proved an insuperable obstacle in the career which I had chalked out for myself has peculiarly fitted me for a new and more extended sphere of usefulness. And I feel sure that if educated blind men only knew what happiness is to be derived from devoting their lives to a useful work for which their very blindness specially qualifies them, there would be no lack of intelligent workers.
Thomas Rhodes Armitage documents some of the many methods of reading that were available before it was realised that letters and symbols on paper could be raised up.
Various attempts have been made from time to time to enable the blind to read by touch. Some of these were extremely ingenious, such as the adaptation of the string records of Peru, in which different forms of knots made on a string stand for different letters, and the blind man was able to read by running the string through his fingers. But since Monsieur Oye's happy idea of printing in relief on paper, all other methods have only an antiquarian interest. In 1784, Monsieur Valentin Oye commenced the first printing in raised characters for the blind and founded the Institut des Jeunes Aveugles, which was the first and is still the best managed and finest blind school in the world. The character he chose was the italic, or written form, of the Roman letter. Braille's invention was only an improvement, though a very great one, on a previously existing writing frame introduced by Monsieur Barbier in 1820. Barbier's frame was, in principle, the same as Braille's, but his full number of dots was 12 instead of 6, so that his letters were unwieldy and the space covered by them inconveniently large. Braille first soldered strips of metal across Barbier's frame, by which means he obtained the power of writing his own more compact alphabet, and afterwards arrived at the form of frame which is still used and bears his name.
The problem was that any given generous benefactor who wanted to help the blind would not invest in an existing system to read and write by touch, but instead invent their own, leading to a number of conflicting systems and no clear method. So the society Rhodes founded began to research the effectiveness of different European and American raised alphabets for both reading and writing. In 1870, after interviewing many blind people, the group detailed the advantages of the dotted systems being used throughout America and Europe, and therefore endorsed Braille. There was a long argument for using embossed letters, and indeed that system still exists in the Moon alphabet, although it is seldom used. The Roman alphabet would have been what the gentlemen of the society, having lost sight later in life, were taught in school and had a certain familiarity with, but in the end, Braille was decided as the preferred method.
In England, we have facilities such as do not exist in any other country of ascertaining the relative merits of different systems of raised characters. For in consequence of the numerous methods in use, those among the blind who value reading most are generally acquainted with several. They are thus in a position to judge which of them is the best suited to the purpose of reading by touch. In spite of the strongest prima facie reasons to the contrary, the unanimous decision was come to that the Roman character in all its existing forms is so complicated that it requires long education and great acuteness of touch to read it with ease, and that its universal adoption would be tantamount to the total exclusion of the great majority of the blind from the privilege of reading.
As forward-thinking as Armitage was, the book is still a product of its time, which is reflected in the following list of jobs.
Much public interest has for many years been directed to the best means of employment for the blind. Institutions have sprung up in every part of the country with the praiseworthy object of enabling the blind to support themselves by their own labour, and the good example set by England in this respect is being followed by other countries. The principal trades practiced in the United Kingdom by the blind are the making of baskets, brushes, brooms, mattresses, rugs, mats, the caning of chairs, with knitting and sewing for women. Music is also taught in many institutions, and piano tuning in a few. But neither of these are pursued with the amount of vigour and ability which is necessary to ensure the success which has been attained in other countries. It is difficult to estimate correctly the average earnings of the blind at trades, as so much depends upon the external circumstances in which they happen to be placed. Probably the average is not more than 5 or 6 shillings per week for men and less for women. But the present object is to compare the earnings at manual trades with those which may be obtained by piano tuning and the profession of music. Those workers, therefore, only should be considered who, with the requisite musical talent and instruction, might have become good tuners or teachers of music. Industry, good common sense, and manual dexterity are therefore presupposed. Such men at a trade can probably earn upon an average from about 8 to 12 shillings a week.
Armitage was very keen that British blind institutions become musical schools and train generations of blind piano tuners.
During the first years, the same difficulties and prejudices had to be encountered. But by degrees, makers and the general public grew accustomed to blind tuners, and the obstacles thrown in their way became daily less. Some makers, indeed, made a practice of always sending blind tuners to those among their customers who were most particular. And as the instruction at the institution was kept up to a high standard of excellence, and care was always taken to give a certificate of tuning to those only who were really masters of their art, the blind became more and more popular as tuners. The blind and their friends became every year more alive to the fact that tuning was the best and most remunerative employment they could follow.
Much of the book is made up of diagrams of Braille alphabets and musical notation. And with the now universal adoption of Braille as the way of writing and reading for blind and partially sighted people, the book ends on a positive note.
Now that the Braille system of writing is being generally adopted, much better training can be effected than was formerly possible. For the children can write out their exercises at home and bring them to school, so that the master not only knows what is being done during school hours, but also what amount of preparation has been made at home. And the pupil becomes accustomed to work for himself, which is the first step towards a useful education.
Armitage worked tirelessly for the adoption of Braille and succeeded. And in 1871, he helped establish the Royal Normal College for the Blind, which later became the Royal National College for the Blind in London. He also followed the pupils after school. In 1887, he helped found the Guild of Past Students, for, in quotes, the purpose of mutual aid, especially in the first entry into life. The Guild is still going strong today, as is the British and Foreign Society for Improving the Embossed Literature of the Blind, although you might know it as RNIB.
Thanks, Robert, and David Thorpe, of course. We'll be hearing from another well-loved narrator later in the show, but first...
My name is Elizabeth Proud, and I'm one of the readers of Talking Books and have been for the past 52 and a bit years. And I'd like to wish the RNIB a very, very happy 150th anniversary. I'm amazed that 52 of those years I've actually been working here.
This is Anne Cleaves, a crime writer, and I'd like to wish RNIB happy 150th anniversary.
Hi, my name is Caroline Casey. I'm a dangerous dreamer and the founder of Hashtag Valuable. And I want to wish RNIB a very, very, very happy 150th anniversary.
Hello there, it's Anne Hornsby, Director of Mind's Eye. I'd like to wish the RNIB a very happy 150th birthday. Thank you for all your help in reaching blind and partially sighted audiences for audio description, and many more happy returns to come.
Hello, this is Sally Magnuson. Happy 150th anniversary to RNIB.
This is Lord Chris Holmes, wishing RNIB a very, very happy 150th anniversary.
Hi, this is Chris Danielson, Director of Public Relations for the National Federation of the Blind in the United States, and I want to wish the Royal National Institute of Blind People a happy 150th birthday.
This is Blind Dave Healy, wishing the RNIB a very happy 150th anniversary.
Happy 150th anniversary, RNIB. I'm Michelle Acton, and I'm Chief Executive at Fight for Sight. We're really pleased to work alongside the RNIB and, of course, the wonderful RNIB Connect Radio.
Hi there, I'm Billy Baxter from Blind Veterans UK, and I'd like to wish the RNIB a very, very happy 150-year anniversary. God bless you all.
Hello, I'm Sophie Hannah, crime writer and poet, and I would just like to wish RNIB a very, very happy 150th anniversary.
Hi, I'm John Rafferty, President and CEO of CNIB. A special happy anniversary to RNIB on its 150 years from everyone in Canada, and on behalf of the blind communities on this side of the pond, thanks for doing everything you've done.
Hello, this is Miles Hilton-Barber, Blind Adventure, saying to all of you beautiful people within the RNIB, happy 150-year anniversary. God bless you. Onwards and upward. You've changed my life. Keep it up.
Congratulations to the RNIB on their 150th anniversary from everyone at the Scottish Disability Golf and Curling Charity.
My name is Fred Schroeder, and on behalf of the World Blind Union and 253 million blind and partially sighted people around the world, we wish to congratulate the RNIB for 150 years of helping expand opportunities for blind and partially sighted people, for giving them access to education, employment, independent living, and the opportunity to live with dignity. Thank you, RNIB.
What were people reading 150 years ago? Not much if they were blind, unless they had someone to read for them. But if they did, here are two titles first published in 1868 that have become classics. Little Women by Louisa May Alcott. Set in New England during the American Civil War, this is the story of four sisters experiencing both hardship and adventure. Grown-up Meg, tomboyish Joe, timid Beth, and precocious Amy, four March sisters couldn't be more different. But with their father away at war and their mother working to support the family, they have to rely on one another. Whether they're putting on a play, forming a secret society, or celebrating Christmas, there's one thing they can't help but wondering. Will father return home safely? Loosely based on the life of the author and her siblings, Little Women is available in Braille, giant print, and as talking book number 21665.
Christmas won't be Christmas without any presents, grumbled Joe, lying on the rug. It's so dreadful to be poor, sighed Meg, looking down at her old dress. I don't think it's fair for some girls to have plenty of pretty things and other girls nothing at all, added little Amy with an injured sniff. We've got father and mother and each other, said Beth contentedly from her corner. The four young faces on which the firelight shone brightened at the cheerful words, but darkened again as Joe said sadly, "We haven't got Father, and shall not have him for a long time." She didn't say, "Perhaps never," but each silently added it, thinking of Father far away where the fighting was. Nobody spoke for a minute. Then Meg said in an altered tone, "You know, the reason Mother proposed not having any presents this Christmas was because it is going to be a hard winter for everyone, and she thinks we ought not to spend money for pleasure when our men are suffering so in the army. We can't do much, but we can make our little sacrifices, and ought to do it gladly. But I am afraid I don't." And Meg shook her head, as she thought regretfully of all the pretty things she wanted.
Also first published in 1868 is a book that inspired an entire genre. The Moonstone by Wilkie Collins was a Victorian sensation and the first great crime novel. A fabulous yellow diamond becomes the dangerous inheritance of Rachel Verinder. Outside her country house, Hindu priests keep vigil, waiting to reclaim this ancient talisman looted from their holy city. So, when the Moonstone disappears, the case looks simple. But in mid-Victorian England, no one is what they seem, and nothing can be taken for granted. Witnesses, suspects, and detectives each take up the story in turn. The bemused butler, the love-struck housemaid, the enigmatic detective Sergeant Cuff, the drug-addicted scientist, each speculate on the mystery as Collins weaves their narratives into a masterpiece of suspense.
The events related by Gabriel Betteridge, house steward in the service of Julia Lady Verinder. In the first part of Robinson Crusoe at page 129, you will find it thus written: "Now I saw, though too late, the folly of beginning a work before we count the cost, and before we judge rightly of our own strength to go through with it. Only yesterday I opened my Robinson Crusoe at that place. Only this morning, May the 21st, 1850, came my lady's nephew, Mr. Franklin Blake, and held a short conversation with me as follows. 'Betteridge,' says Mr. Franklin, 'I have been to the lawyers about some family matters, and among other things we have been talking of the loss of the Indian diamond in my aunt's house in Yorkshire 2 years since. Mr. Bruff thinks, as I think, that the whole story ought, in the interests of the truth, to be placed on record in writing, and the sooner the better.'"
The Moonstone is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB library, including as TB1367, narrated by Eric Gillett.
Get all the latest news and more for people with sight loss by connecting with RNIB on Facebook and Twitter. Support us on social media for all sorts of extras. And it's a great way of networking with like-minded people. Search for RNIB on Facebook and follow us now on @RNIB. Follow us and find out more about the UK's leading sight loss charity and feel part of the RNIB family.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Elizabeth Proud has one of the best-loved and most recognisable voices in the RNIB library. In a career spanning 6 decades, she's narrated a total of 222 titles, including many by some of the best-loved authors of the last 150 years, such as E. Nesbitt, Philippa Pierce, Catherine Cookson and Kate Atkinson. So it was an honour to meet her in person when she came to the newly refurbished RNIB Talking Book Studio. Elizabeth, I was doing my homework and I see that we've got 222 books that have been narrated by you, which argues that you've been doing it for a few years now.
Yes, I've been reading for Talking Books for over 52 years now.
Are there any books that really stick out as memorable ones during those 52 years?
Ah, well, of course, you do get a lot of things that you don't particularly like. Shall I mention Mills and Boone? Oh, Barbara Cartland. I really can't... Well, I have read Barbara Cartland books, but she's very, very difficult to read because she can't write in paragraphs. And the thought doesn't flow, so that is really difficult to read. Somebody that I actually know, I can't really call her a friend, but I love her work, A.S. Byatt. I've done several of her books, quite difficult, but really worth doing. I've done a lot of children's books, which were great to do, because I like children's writing.
Well, the list of children's books is... It's all the great classics, from E. Nesbitt to Jacqueline Wilson, with books like Heidi and Black Beauty and The Silver Sword and Br'er Rabbit. And the list goes on. I know your reading of Tom's Midnight Garden by...
Oh, Philippa Pierce, she's a wonderful writer. Really, really wonderful writer. And it's very interesting that I've been reading something for myself about her writing and about the whole... It's sort of pre-sci-fi, really. Because it happens on two time levels, two time scales. Yes, I love that.
Do you prefer reading the children's books to adult fiction, or are you...
No, anything that's good.
I take it you must have been an avid reader from when you were a little girl. Otherwise, you would never have volunteered to read audiobooks.
Yes, I was a bookworm. I've always been a bookworm. In fact, I learnt to read on my grandfather's knee, reading a book that I've now lost. And I'd be very interested if anybody listening to this could come across it. It was about a funny little creature called Parlicoot, who was a bit like Bambi, looked a little bit like Bambi, and he had some friends. And the first line of the book, which was quite big, but it wasn't a pop-up book, I was three, and sitting on my grandfather's knee, and it was, "One morning, Parlicoot went to see his friends in the forest." And, of course, this was during the Second World War. We didn't have very many books at all. There was no paper, quite apart from anything else. So we'd read it over and over and over again. I knew it backwards, but I remember the moment when the letters, the actual... one O-N-E, morning, when they moved together and became a word instead of separate. I don't know whether that makes any sense, but it was an epiphany to me. And I always, as it were, had my nose in a book after that. I was also very ill when I was a child. I had everything that was going, and then polio. And so I spent a lot of time in bed with a book quite often.
And what led you to the RNIB Talking Book Studios in the first place?
Well, I was stage struck from the age of about four or five, and I wanted to be a ballet dancer, really. But I got polio, so that wasn't possible. But I held on to being stage struck because I had a lovely fairy godmother aunt called Auntie Clara. Now, just think about that name. Clara. Everybody says Clara now, but the English pronunciation, certainly in the 50s, 40s and 50s, was Clara. And the same thing for Mariah. Mariah in Twelfth Night shouldn't be Maria. The rhythm is all wrong. Anyway, Auntie Clara was, by our family standards, quite rich. She'd married Wool in Bradford. And every Boxing Day, she... bought the front two rows of the Royal Circle in the Alhambra Theatre in Bradford to go to the pantomime. And if you were able to behave yourself, I think I was four when I first went, you went to the pantomime, and I just fell in love with the Moth Ballet. The sequins and all the glitter, and, you know, the war was so drab, especially in the north of England. So there I was, stage struck, which continued. When I got to my grammar school. We'd moved south. My mother and I had moved south by then. It was very enlightened, and we had clubs on Thursday afternoons, and of course I joined the dramatic club. So, girls' school, I played Hamlet when I was 17, and various other leads. I made all the costumes, I helped with the scenery, I did everything, I loved it. And my mother said, remember, this was a grammar school, when I was 17, I really wanted to go to RADA. And she said, well, I can see that you have what I would call a vocation. She was a teacher, very good teacher. But it's a world we know nothing about, and your father would have wanted you to go to university if you could. Now, this was something I couldn't argue with this. I don't remember my father at all. He was killed by the time I was two, I think. So I couldn't reply to this, but I did sort of do it on my own terms. Instead of doing all the entrance examinations, I only did the entrance examinations for Cambridge because I knew I could act more in Cambridge than in Oxford. This was 56, 57. And I went to Girton. I cycled a lot, which is quite a thing now that I'm disabled, but never mind. And I joined all the clubs that I could, and I did as much acting as I possibly could there, reviews to Shakespeare and everything in between. And, of course, one met professional directors, producers then, and one of them, Michael Bakewell, said, I think you should learn about radio. I think you should learn to use a microphone. And so he gave me a tiny part. You wouldn't be able to do that now. You wouldn't be able to afford it over one Christmas. And I was terrified. I was just so frightened. But in 1965, having done various things and been out of work in the usual way of actors, I joined was asked to join the BBC Drama Repertory Company, which we then called the REP, but is now called the Radio Drama Company, the RDC. And you do everything then. You get a script, sometimes for the same day. There was schools radio, there was Radio 3, third programme then. So it was an extraordinary mix across the board. And it took me about 6 years to stop being frightened of the microphone. But then I learnt that it was my friend, and I learnt how to use it, to move closer to it if I wanted to sound really sexy and intimate, or move away from it if I wanted to go out of the room, for instance.
And technology must have changed an enormous amount over those 60 years.
Yes. Yes, indeed it did. We started off with the old-fashioned radio mono microphones that you see, the square sort of in a frame of metal. And it was very easy to blow into those. They didn't have these lovely baffles that you have now. So you had to learn to breathe beside the microphone, as it were, and not always to speak on the breath, which is not what you do when you're singing. So, you know, it's a different skill. But I loved it. I've always liked the exercise of a skill. I did a lot of dubbing at the same time. And, dubbing films, it's very little done now. But then you did a lot of foreign language films dubbed into English, sometimes very well, sometimes you can't tell.
And you were telling me a lovely story about acting with Vincent Price.
Ah, yes, and this is to do with the technology, because in the 60s, in came stereo. Indeed, there was one director who was into quadraphonics, the whole quadrasonic sound, and that was tremendous. But we decided that it was only he and his wife who was ever going to listen to it. Anyway. From working on these square, boxy mono mics, you had your opposite number, the other person in the scene, or people on the other side, so you could look at them and interact in that sort of way. And then came stereo, where the microphone was set against the wall and we stood round in a circle. And I did not exactly an Edgar Allan Poe, but it was a horror radio play with Vincent Price, who I'd worked with on television, actually, before, so I knew him. And he was horrified by this. He said, "Do you mean we have to speak the whole thing to the wall?" And we did. You couldn't even turn your head to the man or woman beside you, because your voice would change. Your voice would move away from the microphone.
And it's not just the technology that's changed over the years. I also notice how much the voice has changed on R&IB talking books over the decades, that the received pronunciation that was very prevalent in the 50s and 60s has given away to a far more natural voice.
I suppose so, although in the 50s and 60s we thought that was natural. My natural accent, I don't think I've got one now anymore, but I moved south at the end of the war from Stockton-on-Tees, and I was made great sport with in the new school I went to, because I said bath and path and gas mask. And children are incredibly sensitive about that sort of thing. I very soon learnt to speak Fen, really. Cambridgeshire Fen. And I remember one of my teachers saying, "But you mustn't lose your beautiful clean vowels." I didn't know I had clean vowels at the age of 7. However, I have always been... I recognise voices. I'm tuned into it, sort of. And I've taught in radio, in drama schools, about 4 drama schools I've taught in. And I've taught radio and how to use the microphone. And I've written for radio.
Do you think it's a prerequisite for an actor, especially a voice actor, to have a good ear for accents then?
It helps. It certainly helps. As does a certain amount of, certainly if you're reading for the RNIB, a certain amount of education. When I started in 1966, early in 1966, I could still go to the lovely BBC pronunciation unit, which is no more, and ask them how to pronounce things. So you hear in the RNIB, if you get a book with words you can't pronounce, you're on your own. You have to do your own research, your own homework. And some of my friends who still do a lot, I've got some, but they have a whole shelf full of pronunciation dictionaries. And I've got old-fashioned dictionaries which give you pronunciations. And there are websites that you can go to. But you have to do that. Otherwise, you can come up with some very embarrassing pronunciations, which I'm sure everybody listening has probably heard BBC announcers are now doing. I mean, I'm sometimes screaming at the radio, saying, "You don't pronounce it like that." One day, when there was a good deal of kicking, my mother whinnied to me to come to her. And then she said, "I wish you to pay attention to what I am going to say to you. The colts who live here are very good colts, but they are cart horse colts, and of course they have not learned manners. You have been well bred and well born. Your father has a great name in these parts, and your grandfather won the cup 2 years at the Newmarket races. Your grandmother had the sweetest temper of any horse I ever knew, and I think you have never seen me kick or bite. I hope you will grow up gentle and good, and never learn bad ways. Do your work with a good will, lift your feet up well when you trot, and never bite or kick, even in play."
My my guest, Elizabeth Proud, narrating Black Beauty by Anna Sewell, which is TB1713. For a full list of the scores of titles that she's narrated for the RNIB Talking Books Library, go to the website rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999. Do you have a favourite narrator that you love to listen to? Or maybe you've got an educating read suggestion for a book that you think would expand my horizons? Why not drop us a line via email? The address is readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. A writer who hasn't let blindness stand in the way of success is Paola Peretti. Her beautiful debut novel, The Distance Between Me and the Cherry Tree, was published earlier this year to much critical acclaim. It's the story of 9-year-old Mafalda, who learns that she's going to lose her sight completely within the next 6 months. Can she find her way through a seemingly dark future and still go to school, play football, and look after her beloved cat, Otamatukaret? With the help of her family and friends, Mafalda needs to discover the things that will be important to her once her sight has gone. The story was inspired by Paola's own experience of Stargardt disease. And, like Mafalda, she lives in Italy. But she was in London for the book's UK publication. And, after visiting the RNIB studios, was inspired to give us a very special gift, a 150-word story featuring Mafalda and Otamatukaret to mark RNIB's 150th anniversary. And, like her novel, it's narrated by Rosie Ackerman.
The Story of a Philosophical Cat by Paola Peretti. My mum found me up a tree. My eyes were sore. I kept rubbing them, but whatever it was wouldn't go away. She climbed up to get me, then took me home with her. We drank milk together. She bathed my eyes and I was fine again. I follow her everywhere, to check she's okay. And because I like it when she strokes me with her smooth hands. She goes to the same place every morning. I wait for her in the bushes. I could pick her out of a crowd anywhere. She walks as if it were always dark, although she has an inner light of her own. It must be her smile when she feels me in her arms. She tells me about the many things that happened to her. Sometimes she's sad, because of the dark, I think. But she laughs as soon as I start to jump around in the grass. She doesn't have pointy ears like me, and she bumps into things quite often. My mum's just a little girl. And what's the problem with that?
The Story of a Philosophical Cat by Paola Peretti, written and narrated especially for RNIB's 150th anniversary. And you can find her novel, The Distance Between Me and the Cherry Tree, in the RNIB library in Braille, giant print, and as TB24549. It's also available in print wherever you buy your books. At the beginning of the show, we heard about the formation of what was to become RNIB and about some of its 150-year history. Now, to bring us up to date and focus on the years to come, let's talk to someone responsible for shaping policy today. Keith Valentine is RNIB's Director of Development. He joined us this summer, having been CEO of Vision UK, the body he helped set up to promote eye health, equality and access to services for those with sight loss. He's also an avid reader and, like me, has retinitis pigmentosa, so I knew we were going to have plenty to talk about. Keith Valentine, welcome to RNIB Connect Radio. So you came to us from Vision UK, where you were CEO, and it's a body that you helped set up. Can you tell us a little bit more about it and what you bring from there to RNIB?
At root, it was a very simple idea. Visually impaired people, I mean, me and you both, I'm sure many people listening know that there are many different things that affect our lives, different organisations, from hospitals and clinics, doctors, optometrists, ophthalmologists, government bodies, companies, charities, all of these sorts of things. So the simple idea in the middle of all of that was to try and create a focal point where all of those different bits could communicate with each other to get things done more efficiently, by which I don't necessarily mean more cheaply, but that they get to, you know, fulfil their mission to help visually impaired people get on with life. As with all these things, simple in concept, I always like to say the ideas are light and the delivery is heavy. So there was a lot of work in that year in trying to create something that was actually adding value, rather than just creating another thing to do for a sector that's sadly very busy. In my appointment to this role, one of the things that was very clear earlier on is that it's relatively unique in the leadership of the organisation, in that I don't have a big department or anything other than a portfolio to try and help the RNIB drive itself to be the best that it possibly can for the community that it serves. So in a sense, what I bring from Vision UK is that network, that kind of, you know, I mean, I know a lot of the people that make the things work in the country for visually impaired people. You know, I never expected to work for a charity. I've been in all the sectors. So I've worked for local government and the NHS, and I had my own business for some years, and also ran a social enterprise. And it was actually losing my eyesight helped push me to a critical decision, was that I felt that I had to go and work for people when I'd worked for myself for very many years, partly because it was before all of these iPhones and iPads and all of the technology. So I was quite scared, I've got to be honest with you, about whether I was going to be able to work. I've got a background of a family that have gone blind in every generation, all of whom have worked. So I couldn't go there for any, cuddles and don't worry, it'll be all right. I went there for straightforward advice about getting on with it, which I am grateful for now. At the time, it could have done with being a little bit gentler, but I can see it myself in, you know, looking at what the RNIB is here to do, what I've been trying to do with Vision UK, and from that personal experience of just trying to keep myself going and getting into work, that there's a genuine authenticity in the brand that we're launching and the See Differently, you know, idea, and hopefully people are starting to pick up on that. And what I'm bringing to this isn't simply a kind of a professional knowledge of how things fit together and what we can get done. It's a sense of the reason to do that, and the importance of, you know, an RNIB that's vital, that's easily accessible for our, you know, the users of our services. I think I'd be interesting to hear what people think, actually, you yourself, that there's a modernity in the brand. There's a sense of, you know, the purpose in life, in getting on with things, that life, you know, can be good as we overcome the difficulties that visual impairment gives us. So, you know, the technical knowledge I get from a professional background, I think it's there, but I hope what I've got is a zest for what it's possible for us to do. Myself, having been in that dark room, losing my eyesight, not knowing if I was going to be able to contribute to, you know, paying for my family, not knowing what the future held for me, you know, whether I'd experience prejudice, all of that. Having been sat in that room, I know how dark it is. So I really do want to stress as well, when I say a zest for life and optimism, I'm not in any way saying, oh, it's easy, have a cup of tea and get on with it. You know, I understand how tough it can be. I guess my message is that it's worth fighting for it, because life can be good.
Well, here on Read On, we have a section called Books of Your Life. I'll start off by asking you if there is a book that you read as a child or a young man that made you fall in love with reading.
I fell in love with an author. That's Charles Dickens. I come from quite a fragmented background, and my father was often very absent from my life. And a few times he turned up on my birthday, once when I was 9 years old, and took me out for the day in London. And, you know, this is a guy that, he wasn't one of these fathers that, you know, was a nightmare to be around. He was actually a really kind of powerful, charismatic figure. So often any problems I've got with my father, sadly passed away now, was to do with his absence more than his presence. So at 9 years old, was the first of two or three years in a row of really, really magical days out on my own with my father in London. The first time, he took me to Charles Dickens' house on Doughty Street, this peculiar little museum. I still go and make them show me around it from scratch, just because I enjoy the different stories that they tell as they do it, and you get a different one every time, believe me. And then we found the old building of the old curiosity shop, and he talked to me about Charles Dickens, and from that I started to read in very different different ways. And obviously you've got the musical Oliver. So I guess I kind of need to choose a book by Charles Dickens. And that's such a difficult thing to do. I've read every bit of it. So I'm going to pick one that I know that I read when I was young. I would say I'm probably on my fifth reading of it so far. And each time the themes, the way the book works, changes with my life and I get something else out of it. And that is Our Mutual Friend It's a book full of deceptions and rich social critique. It's got some very, very dark things as it goes, and there are murders and mysteries in it, and you're never quite sure what's going on with some of the characters.
In these times of ours, though concerning the exact year there is no need to be precise, a boat of dirty and disreputable appearance, with two figures in it, floated on the Thames between Southwark Bridge, which is of iron, and London Bridge, which is of stone, as an autumn evening was closing in. The figures in this boat were those of a strong man with ragged, grizzled hair and a sun-browned face, and a dark girl of 19 or 20, sufficiently like him to be recognizable as his daughter. The girl rowed, pulling a pair of sculls very easily. The man, with the rudder lines slack in his hands, and his hands loose in his waistband, kept an eager lookout. He had no net, hook, or line, and he could not be a fisherman. His boat had no cushion for a sitter, no paint, no inscription, no appliance beyond a rusty boat-hook and a coil of rope, and he could not be a waterman. His boat was too crazy and too small to take in a cargo for delivery, and he could not be a lighterman or river carrier. There was no clue to what he looked for, but he looked for something with a most intent and searching gaze.
Our Mutual Friend by Charles Dickens is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB1677, narrated by Peter Reynolds. And is there a book that you would like to curl up with and reread on a rainy day?
There's a particular book by Tom Wolfe from the 80s that isn't really a cozying up by the fire thing, but I kind of would love to cozy up by the fire with it. And it's a book of substantial size. I've no idea of the listening time. I have listened to it on our talking books. It was a book that I spent a whole holiday reading years ago when I could read off the page. I have to say, our version of it on the talking books is absolutely fantastic. I recommend it. This is the story I think would read well now in the Trump era. It's very much about the glitz and glamour of life in New York. They're living the high life, you know, and it's written at the time where you had that real breakout of financier capitalism and people were, you know, were making lots of money. And the main character, Sherman, is doing those things you could imagine people with that kind of money would do. So the drugs and he's a mistress and... You know, it's you know, it's the toxic life when you've got so much money, all you can really think to do is spend it and get more, you know. And it's the story of how his wealth, his position in society starts to unwind in a series of unfortunate events. It really starts to unstitch the problems that existed under this shell of wealth in New York.
The Bonfire of the Vanities by Tom Wolfe. At that very moment, in the very sort of Park Avenue co-op apartment that so obsessed the mayor, 12-foot ceilings, two wings, one for the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants who owned the place and one for the help, Sherman McCoy was kneeling in his front hall trying to put a leash on a dachshund. The floor was a deep green marble, and it went on and on. It led to a 5-foot-wide walnut staircase that swept up in a sumptuous curve to the floor above. It was the sort of apartment the mere thought of which ignites flames of greed and covetousness under people all over New York, and, for that matter, all over the world. But Sherman burned only with the urge to get out of this fabulous spread of his for 30 minutes. So here he was, down on both knees, struggling with a dog, the dachshund, he figured, was his exit visa.
Heywood Morse narrating Bonfire of the Vanities by Tom Wolfe, which is TB11276 and also available in Braille. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
It's Wolf Hall is one of those books that I think is a little bit Marmite. For those of the people that don't know, it tells the story of Thomas Cromwell. He is arguably one of the most mercurial and difficult to understand figures in history, certainly in our modern interpretations of the role of Thomas Cromwell in Henry VIII's government. The Wolf Hall book is quite controversial in that it plays him as the rational, future-forming minister of state, creating the first aspects of our modern constitutional democracy and all sorts of things that underpin that. It's a stonking good read. The story, for example, with Anne Boleyn, it can only go one way. We know, sadly, what occurred.
So let me be sure I have this right, Morgan says. He comes home yesterday with his clothes torn and his knuckles skinned. And the old man says, what's this, been fighting? He waits a day, then hits him with a bottle, then knocks him down in the yard, kicks him all over, beats up and down his length with a plank of wood that comes to hand. Did he do that? It's all over the parish. They were lining up on the wharf to tell me. They were shouting at me before the boat tied up. Morgan Williams, listen now. Your wife's father has beaten Thomas, and he's crawled, dying, to his sister's house. They've called the priest. Did you call the priest? Oh, you Williamses, Cat says. You think you're such big people round here. People are lining up to tell you things. But why is that? It's because you believe anything. But it's right, Morgan yells. Well, as good as right, eh? If you leave out the priest, and that he's not dead yet.
Wolf Hall by Hilary Mantel is available in a full range of accessible formats, including as TB16735, narrated by Christopher Oxford. Keith Valentine, thank you so much for sharing your obvious passion for reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on RNIB Connect Radio.
It's been an absolute pleasure. See you again.
Don't forget, you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, complete with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or you can find producer Robert on Twitter @talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.